You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. You can take your seats. I'm Norm Eisen of the Governance Studies Program, and together with my GS colleague, Ben Wittes, I'm very pleased to welcome you to our conference on the state of the rule of law, where we are and where we are going. I want to thank the Democracy Fund and Brookings Progress Project for supporting today's event. I'm very grateful that we will be joined on our strong bipartisan panels distinguished members of Congress. I want everyone to know that we invited leading members of Congress from both parties to join us. We ended up having a stronger representation from the minority party, but chairs of committees were invited to today's proceedings. We gather at a time of great challenge to the rule of law in the United States, a level of challenge that we have not seen in our country in a very long time. We're faced with a president who has relentlessly assaulted the rule of law. He's verbally attacked judges and disputed long disputed the Russian attack on our democracy before grudgingly conceding it. He's attacked the independence of his own Department of Justice, including the Attorney General, the Deputy Attorney General, and Special Counsel Robert Mueller. He's behaved, President Trump has, in ways that some allege transgress the rule of law, including the Constitution, statutes, ethics and norms, critically important to the functioning of rule of law in America. He's presented us of late with a Supreme Court nominee who has himself precipitated a perhaps unprecedented furor over his alleged conduct and candor. Perhaps most fundamentally, the president and those around him, including some of his congressional allies, have assaulted truth itself. And we're presented, as we gather here today, with the question of whether the rule of law can function in an environment in which truth is attacked. Some of the questions we will be asking today are what the effects of all of this and other factors are on the rule of law, what the present and long-term damage may be, and how to repair it. It's very, very important that we not only in the best tradition of Brookings identify the problems, but look for the solutions. There's no one better to do that than our first speaker, one of the leaders in Congress working to address these issues. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse has served as the senator, a senator from Rhode Island since 2007. He's a member, most relevantly for us today, of the Committee on the Judiciary, as well as Budget, Environment, and Public Works, and Finance. He's also a former Attorney General of Rhode Island and a former United States Attorney. Thank you, Senator Whitehouse, for your leadership and for kicking off our conference on the rule of law today.
Thank you, Norm, and thank you, Brookings, and thank you all for being here, and thank you for allowing me the chance to provide a little context to the day's conversation. Years ago in his Bunker Hill speech, Daniel Webster famously described the work of our founders as having set the world an example. From Jonathan Winthrop to Ronald Reagan, we have called ourselves a city on a hill, set high for the world to witness. President Clinton argued that the world has always been more impressed by the power of our example than any example of our power. America has long stood before the world as an exceptional country, and America's exceptional nature confers upon us responsibilities. That is not a burden that we bear, that is an asset that we command. As the son, grandson, and nephew of Foreign Service officers, I learned young that when the chips are down, there is no competition to the United States of America in the hopes and dreams of people around the world. The power of our example draws people to our country, our ideals, and our mode of government. This tidal force has flooded in our favor for generations and helped make America the essential nation. But if you want to be the example, you have to live the example. Back to Daniel Webster. The last hopes of mankind therefore rest with us. And if it should be proclaimed that our example had become an argument against the experiment, the knell, the death knell, he meant, of popular liberty would be sounded throughout the earth. Today we are dangerously failing to live our example. Look at America's failure to lead on climate change. We have clear scientific understanding of how carbon pollution harms the world's climate and oceans, yet we fail to act. Our fossil fuel producers knowingly cause this harm and aggressively fight political solutions to the problem using an arsenal of political money, much of it run through dark money channels to hide their hand. Congress has shown itself unable to resist this power despite obvious and enormous conflicts of interest. It is corruption in plain view. The poorest people of the world, those who live closest to the land, will suffer the brunt of the coming change. That suffering will raise resentments about a democratic system that succumbed to dark money influence and about a brand of capitalism that allowed industry to perpetuate the problem in the pursuit of profit. This failure, both of popular democracy and market capitalism, will be a lasting blot on our American example. Another failure is our aiding and abetting of kleptocracy and corruption around the world. There is a real clash of civilizations, to borrow Samuel Huntington's phrase. It is between societies that reflect the rule of law and regimes of kleptocracy, criminality, and authoritarian abuse. Ironically, the most successful looters of the corrupt, unstable countries in the world seek the shelter of rule of law for their stolen pelf. Rather than demand transparency, we have a whole industry to cater to the looters. As the infamous Panama Papers and Paradise Papers revealed, American law firms, realtors, shell corporations, and financial services enable international crooks and thugs. This is another continuing blot on the reputation of American capitalism and our democratic system. And if you live in a country robbed blind by crooked rulers, it is hard not to resent a country that helped them get away with it. Deserved discredit will fall on the institutions that we treasure, capitalism and democracy, that failed so visibly in the face of these well-known evils. We damage our brand at our peril. As a prosecutor, I look around stunned at what I see. Presidents are not supposed to supervise, initiate, or interfere with law enforcement investigations or prosecutions. Not of political opponents, not of anyone. That's the way banana republics behave, not the government of the United States of America. Today, we see troubling signs that this separation is being circumvented by tweet and other forms of pressure. The Department of Justice is ordinarily protected from this kind of pressure by long-held standards and firewalls designed to ensure its independence and integrity. But the president is a fire hose of political attack, lashing about and smashing these and other rules and norms of the presidency. Congress has the tools to investigate this political interference with our nation's law enforcement and protect the Department of Justice from abuse, but Congress lies supine. Finally, we are now in the process of a bitter fight over the seating of a swing judge onto the United States Supreme Court. The very political force that is being deployed to jam this individual onto the court is a strong signal that there is something more going on at the court than just calling balls and strikes. Under the tenure of Chief Justice Roberts, there have been 70 decisions in which the court split 5-4, with all the Republicans making up the five, in which decisions, precedent and principle were overridden, and through which decisions, big significant wins were given to big Republican interests. That is not the image of America we want the world to see. If you believe that the world needs America, if you believe that the world's America is the world's essential and exceptional nation, then getting rule of law right matters. Failing in moments of necessity will both soon and long darken the lamp America holds up to the world. The world is watching. In the international contest of ideologies, it is not assured that ours will win. We have to earn the winner's laurel generation by generation, and we have to win it by example. America still is an exemplary nation, and we have a role to play in this world, we Americans, and by God, it is time we got about it. Thank you very much.
So while my co-panelists are coming up here, let me just give a little bit of information. My name is Benjamin Wittes. I'm a senior fellow here. I'm going to dispense with introductions. You have information about the speakers and bios in the materials, and we are a little short of time on all these panels, and I want to leave as much room as possible for people to engage with you guys. So I will just say this is a remarkable group of people to discuss the subject of the sort of impact of our current environment on national security investigations with. And I'm very grateful to all three of my panelists for coming, joining us today. I think the issue that we're discussing has at least two major elements, or maybe more than that, but I want to break out two and treat them separately. One is the impact of the environment on national security investigations within the executive branch. And the second is the conduct of Congress in the conduct of its own national security investigations. Now, these two subjects overlap, but they are different, and I want to start by talking about them separately. So, Mary, I want to start with you. In your last role at the Justice Department, were acting director of the National Security Division, where a lot of these investigations take place. And you were there for a period that was jarring for the department in a very profound way. And I'm just interested in your sort of gestalt impressions of how the current environment is affecting no particular investigation, not asking for anything sensitive, but what is the impact of our political environment on the conduct of Justice Department national security investigations?
Sure, Ben, and thanks for having me here. It's a pleasure to be part of this panel. For those who might not know, I left the department in May of 2017, which means I was there for several months after the change of administration. I was a career department attorney. I had been a prosecutor at the U.S. Attorney's Office for 20 years before spending 3 years in the National Security Division. So I had a long history of following what we call the rule of law. And I think one of the things that's important to keep in mind in these times that we're in, when there's a lot of alarmism, is that by and large, despite the headlines, despite the tweets, despite what the president may think rule of law is, that he gets to make it and others get to follow it, the people, career and political, in the Department of Justice, I think, do have respect for the rule of law. They do recognize that this is a compact between the government and the governed, by which there will be transparency and stability and predictability, and by which there is a fair process for the resolution of rights and responsibilities by independent, nonpartisan lawyers and judges, and that they strive on a daily basis, I think, to ensure that that is the process that is followed. And as I said, despite what we've seen really since this administration came into office in terms of the president, I think, at the very beginning, not understanding what rule of law meant and really thinking that he could appoint an attorney general who would have his back and would ensure that this investigation into potential Russian collusion would be deflected away from him. The career and even political men and women in the department have, I think, tried to really put blinders on and move forward with various investigations, whether they're national security criminal investigations, whether they're counterintelligence investigations, or whether they're other criminal or civil investigations. That said, these kind of constant attacks on the institution, not only DOJ, but the Bureau, of which is, you know, these are people who work hand in glove day after day, the prosecutors, the attorneys, and FBI agents, that does start to wear on you. I mean, you can only block so much of it out when you're hearing about it every single day. And so I think it wears on attorneys at DOJ in a variety of ways. First of all, I think that a lot of folks there, and I know this from people I've talked to, feel a little bit differently about saying where they work than they used to feel. And that's just a really sad thing. I think one of the great joys of my career is when I would walk into court and say, Mary McCord on behalf of the United States. I think every prosecutor wants to feel proud of saying that. And I think it's a really difficult time for career attorneys to reconcile what's happening to the department and the attacks the department has been under to feel good about what they're doing. But I hope they will. I also think that over time, even though many people listening to the news understand what the importance of rule of law, understand that investigations are undertaken with purpose and by career people who are doing their job, the constant, you know, calling things witch hunts just day in and day out, it starts to, I worry it creeps in and sinks into sort of like the subconscious of the public, who will then be skeptical of different results. I mean, even when results, investigations, indictments, cases are brought for all the right reasons, you have concerns that there will be people that say they were not brought for the right reasons. And then, of course, there is the possibility that there will be some people within the department or within the Bureau who will succumb to this notion of, I need to do what the president wants me to do. I think that would be a very small minority. I truly believe that. But I know human nature, and those kind of things happen. I think that's, like I said, a smaller worry and the lesser of our worries. But I'm more concerned sort of long term for the damage this does to the reputation of the department, of the people within it as being partisan and not independent, and then the ability of the American people to have faith in decisions made, prosecutions brought, actions taken by the department.
So, Chuck, you also ran a law enforcement agency during the period of transition into this administration. As far as I know, you are the only person who ran a federal law enforcement agency who sent a letter to the entire staff of that law enforcement agency saying the rule of law is a higher value than the words of the president. I'm curious for your thoughts on the, both the question that I asked Mary and also her response to it.
Yeah, thanks, Ben. And by the way, thanks for having me here. It's a real privilege. I think Mary is exactly right. Before I ran anything, I was a line assistant U.S. attorney, and I smiled when Mary described the thrill of standing up in federal court and saying that you were there on behalf of the United States of America. And Ben, I will answer your question. But I will add this first. The rule of law is just a construct, right? The law of gravity is not. The law of gravity is immutable. I mean, and even in countries that don't have rule of law, they have law of gravity. And there's nothing that anyone can do about it. But the rule of law is just a construct. So in some sense, not to be overdramatic, it's always at risk. It's always under threat. If not here, then somewhere in the world. I don't think we're blinking red, Ben, and I don't want to overstate the threat, but we're absolutely blinking amber, in part for what Mary described as well. You know, I think about what the president has done and said, just taking one aspect of it, pardons. And we've had a long and sort of difficult, cumbersome process in the Department of Justice on purpose to make sure that pardons are carefully considered and that they are given for the right reasons. Those tend to be mercy and compassion. And only after many years, and that the use of the pardon power can very quickly undermine the rule of law if given for other reasons, right? And I'm not saying Dinesh D'Souza or Scooter Libby or Joe Arpaio don't deserve pardons, though I have a view on that. Even musings about extending a pardon to Governor Blagojevich, you know, have that tendency to undermine the rule of law because you realize that they're being done for other than mercy and compassion. And so I think the rule of law is always at risk. I think it is particularly at risk in our country today. I also think, for the reasons that Mary cited, we're going to be okay, that the men and women of the department do their jobs day in and day out. It has an effect, sure, more on morale, I think, than on output, but morale counts too. And there's another aspect to what Mary described that I wanted to share with you, which is that when we ask our agents, our cops, to go into neighborhoods and do difficult things, we also hope that they're believed and trusted. Right now, we're asking the FBI to do a very difficult background investigation. By difficult, I mean contentious, and that with whatever result they come up with, that it should be trusted, it should be believed. But for that to happen, when they knock on your door, you also have to let them in. You have to be willing to sit down and talk to them. You have to believe in their output. And if we're not doing that, then we're in big trouble. So, Ben, to your question, and I'll be brief, I sent a letter to our entire DEA workforce because I thought it was important to iterate that we are tethered to the Constitution and to the rule of law and not to the wishes or whims of any one person. My letter to my troops came in response to a speech that the president gave in Suffolk County, New York, in which he condoned, in my view, police brutality and police violence. We're better than that. I don't believe for a second that anybody in federal law enforcement would change their behavior because of what he said. But there is a risk that people will perceive that we'll change our behavior because of what he said. And that is the risk to the rule of law, because the whole system, again, is a construct in which we trust agents and judges and cops and prosecutors to do the right thing relentlessly. And so part of that construct is that leap of faith. And I think that's what's under assault right now.
Congressman, you're in an interesting bridge position here because you both supervise and are doing oversight of these executive branch activities, but you're also responsible for the congressional oversight itself. So I want to start with the executive branch side and then shift to the legislative side. You wrote an open letter to the FBI apologizing for the conduct of your committee, in essence. I'm interested in why you did that.
Ben, thank you for inviting me to join you today. I've written two open letters in the 18 years I've been in Congress, both of them in the last year and a half. The first was to the men and women of the intelligence community, and the second, as you mentioned, was to the men and women of the FBI. For the reason that I wanted both to know how much respect we have for their work, indeed how much respect there is on a bipartisan basis in Congress for what they do, that what they see in terms of the administration, what they see from a handful of very nonetheless influential members of Congress is not reflective of the broad support for their work. And I thought it was important for the reasons that Mary and Chuck itemized that they know this. And because I have to think that there are profound questions among many in the workforce about whether their work is valued. I have to imagine that all around the world, people that cooperate with law enforcement and American intelligence agencies have to wonder whether their identities will be protected, whether the work product that they are producing, that they are risking their lives to supply, will be protected, and whether it will be utilized. And so I do think it's important to underscore that there are a great many of us who have the deepest commitment to them and to what they're doing. There are, you know, sadly, two categories of my colleagues in the GOP right now, the largest group of which are members who are just completely silent. They won't say anything in support of the Justice Department or the FBI. They won't defend the rule of law when it's attacked by the president. They just are hunkering down. They don't want to be in the position of defending the president or the administration, but they also don't want to incur the ire of his supporters back home. But then you have a handful of people who are more than actively complicit in what the president is doing and undermining the rule of law. And I don't want the workforce to think that they're representative of the Congress or even of the GOP in Congress, because what they're doing is singularly harmful. And I do think that when this chapter of history is written, that some of the most damning words will be reserved for members of Congress who looked at the assault on our institutions and did nothing, or worse, they enabled the undermining of our system of checks and balances.
So let me just have you flesh that out. Your committee has been one of two that are really kind of ground zero in that, and maybe yours is really ground zero. What are the things, I mean, what are the specific things, categories of things that your committee has done that you believe are active facilitations of attacks on the rule of law?
Our bread and butter responsibility is to oversee the intelligence agencies. And in order to do that, we need a very capable staff, which we have. But it's a complete mismatch. We're the smallest staff on the Hill, overseeing some of the largest agencies in the country and agencies that are in the business of keeping secrets. Which means you have to know the right questions to ask, but also there has to be a level of trust. The agencies have to believe that they can share with you some of their most closely held information, and you will not abuse that. And you will certainly not make it public, and you will not make it partisan. The single act of using a never-before-housed rule to selectively release classified information in the now infamous Nunes Memorandum was a violation of everything that the committee has stood for. It was a naked politicization of intelligence and a fraudulent one at that. That breach of trust with the intelligence community means that that community now is deeply reluctant to share anything with our committee because they cannot trust that it will be held confidential. The continuing assault by our majority on the Justice Department, on the Deputy Attorney General, on the FBI, the degree to which some of the most prominent members of our committee promulgate these deep state conspiracy theories is uniquely destructive. And, you know, sadly, I think they have forced the Justice Department repeatedly into violating its own policies, which the Justice Department will come to regret. And I've had this conversation, and I like my colleagues are on the panel, come from a U.S. attorney's office. I, too, loved representing the United States, and I feel I still represent the United States. But as I explained in one of my recent visits to the Justice Department to review materials that Congress has no business insisting on obtaining, that is, materials in a pending investigation and others in a closed investigation, I made the point that at some point, the Mueller investigation will come to an end, and one side or the other will be aggrieved by its result. And how am I to explain on the Democratic side of the aisle why we do not demand the same thing the Republicans demanded when they were in the majority, materials which the department has a policy against providing to the Congress, and for good reason, because we shouldn't be in the business of trying to steer pending criminal cases any more than the White House should be. So I think we've done deep destruction to our system of checks and balances, and we are going to have to look, when this ugly chapter is over, at how do we legislate norms that we thought inviolate. And there's a whole list of them. There are things within our power to do and some beyond our power to do. You know, one of the bills I introduced, and this gets to Chuck's point about the abuse of the pardon power, we can't constitutionally by statute somehow cabin the president's pardon power. But we can disincentivize its abuse. And one of the bills I introduced would provide that in any investigation in which the president is a target, subject, or witness, they issue a pardon affecting that investigation, that the investigative files in that case will be provided to Congress. That's a deterrent. It also allows the Congress to determine whether the president is using the pardon to obstruct justice. And we're going to need, I think, ultimately to think about new and creative ways to institutionalize norms that we thought we would never see trampled upon.
So on the subject of the document production demands, I realize that we have here on this panel a person who has run the National Security Division at Justice, a person who has served at the most senior levels of the FBI as well as running the DEA, but the FBI is more relevant here because it's involved in the FISA process, and the ranking member of the Oversight Committee, relevant Oversight Committee, with respect to FISA. So I'm going to pose a simple question to all three of you, and I just want to start at Chuck and move down. Are there any circumstances in which it is reasonable for Congress to be demanding materials, FISA materials, identifying sources from pending investigations?
No.
Mary?
I would agree, no.
I can't envision the circumstances, but what we have seen goes beyond your question, because it's not, in this case, just a matter of, as serious as it is, providing FISA materials in a pending investigation of Congress, but it's the committee's release of those materials publicly for a political purpose. It is the risk of exposure of the sources that provided information in the FISA. So the situation we're living through goes well beyond whether Congress could ever have a legitimate oversight in a FISA application. I don't know that I could answer on the spot and contemplate every circumstance, but it's hard for me to imagine where that would be appropriate, and certainly it would never be appropriate to make a selective or fraudulent release of those materials.
Go ahead.
And following up on that, I think, no is, I think, the right answer. But to be clear, the department and the bureau, they do brief the select intelligence committees about important issues of national security. So for me, in answering no with respect to you know, providing the actual FISA applications is a little different from saying, will the Bureau and the intelligence community appropriately brief the intelligence committees about important national security information that the intelligence committees should know? These are two different things. And I think, as the congressman has indicated, the problem with turning over applications is exacerbated significantly by the use made of those materials, the partisan use made of those. The actual need to ensure that Congress is aware, or certain people in Congress with the highest levels of classification are aware about important threats to national security, I think is indisputable. It's just a matter of doing that and then what is done with the information.
Completely agree.
Yeah, I completely agree. The oversight function is not only crucial, but it's actually fairly robust. I mean, we spend a lot of time not just briefing members of Congress, but there are other executive branch agencies that oversee our work. We have inspectors general throughout the executive branch that look at our work. So I think my no stands. I think the answer is no, but those caveats are important ones, and I agree with them.
And Ben, if I could just remind people of the chronology here, just to show you how absurd and dangerous the situation was. When the majority and the chairman moved to release this selective presentation of the FISA application, the chairman himself had never read the applications. The members of the committee, with one exception, had never read the applications. And I moved that before you release this information, which misrepresents what's in those, why don't you seek a briefing from the FBI about what went in them or access to the documents? They were not even willing to do it. They didn't want to read it. They merely wanted to put out a political memo. And that, I think, shows you just how not only disingenuous it was, but how ultimately dangerous to our national security. And one final point I'll put on this. Recently, the president ordered more of these materials declassified over the objection of the intelligence agencies and the Bureau. What ultimately caused him to walk that back is unclear, but we know from a tweet. Apparently, our allies weighed in to tell the president how damaging that was. Now, you can imagine what might have gone into that, that we needed our allies to persuade the president, that the intelligence agency heads would have had to reach out to their counterparts around the world and say, would you please call our boss? Because he doesn't believe us. He needs you to tell him that this would be damaging. That's the Alice in Wonderland world we're living in. But even after all of that, and even after the president is persuaded that he should at least for a time rescind this order, the members of our committee still insist on its release. They don't care that the allies say it will potentially burn them or their sources. They're still willing to do it. And in that context, how can the IC or our allies ever trust what the Congress will do, much less the president.
So I want to go to audience questions, but before I do, I have one more question of my own, which is that as I said before, the problem here is not merely impact on executive branch investigations and the sins of commission of congressional investigations. It's also sins of omission of congressional investigations, things that should be being investigated that are not. And you have been pretty emphatic that the committee did not investigate the Russia set of matters in a fashion that was adequate to your satisfaction, and that if and when you are ever in charge of that committee, things will look different in terms of that investigation. So I just want to throw out the question, if the House were to flip in November, how does the affirmative oversight, not merely the defense against executive branch activity, but the affirmative oversight activity of the committee look different than it does now?
Well, I would say a couple of things. I think, and first of all of us are more than superstitious about presuming anything in the midterms. We all feel burned by our expectations a couple years ago. But if the House should change hands, I think priority number one has to be restoring the credibility and integrity of our committee and the comity among members of the committee. But in terms of our oversight function, there are certainly particulars in the Russia investigation that were never done. None of it was done very seriously. And probably the most graphic illustration I can give you, because it's very telling about the nature of the GOP-led Russia investigation, is we know that there were calls to and from Don Jr. and Amin Agalarov in the setup of that now infamous Trump Tower meeting. Sandwiched between them was a call from a blocked number. And we know the president used a blocked number during the campaign. So we sought to subpoena the phone records to determine, did the president have prior knowledge of this meeting? Did the president approve of this meeting? And our GOP colleagues said, no, we don't want to know. We won't get those records because we don't want to know. And this was the story of the investigation. That is, we want to rely on the witnesses' denials without any effort to corroborate or refute them. So when the time comes, if the time comes, we'll have to look at what was done and what wasn't done. I'm particularly concerned that no one has investigated the issue of whether the Russians were laundering money through the Trump Organization, and this is the leverage that the Russians have over the President of the United States. To me, not knowing that is negligent with our national security. But quite separate apart from Russia, and this, I think, is the big untold story of what the Russians did. And I guess, first of all, I would say that, as my colleagues on the panel have pointed out, I think this is all too true, what the Russians did in meddling with our democracy is nothing compared with what this administration is doing to meddle with our democracy. The Russians couldn't cause us to distrust our own free press. They couldn't cause us to undermine the independence of the Justice Department. They couldn't cause us to denigrate and belittle our own judiciary. Only we can do that to ourselves. But the big picture, I think, the big untold story here, and something that I would like to have us have open hearings on and private examination and oversight of, is the Russian attack on our democracy was not in isolation. The Russians have been going after democracies in Europe and elsewhere. But more broadly than that is the fact that the whole idea of liberal democracy right now is under assault. We see a rise of authoritarianism around the world. This poses, I think, among the most significant national security threats to our country. And that is something I would like our committee to do some oversight of. That is something I'd like to see our committee do public hearings on, so that the country has an appreciation for the fact it's not just our democracy here at home that's at risk, it's democracy around the world that is currently at risk.
So we can go to your questions now. When you please let me see your hand, and when you got to wait for the microphone, and when it comes, please keep your question brief. I have tried to do that. I will cut you off with a shocking lack of due process if you don't. And please introduce yourself and tell us who you are.
Good morning. My name is Mindy Reiser. I'm vice president of an NGO called Global Peace Services USA. First, a quick comment. Last night, the Holocaust Museum honored Ben Ferenz, who was 99 years old, prosecutor in Nuremberg for the rule of law. Question to Mr. Rosenberg. You talked about the concept of the rule of law. What do you think the Supreme Court will be now that it has been impugned and politicized? What kind of trust can the American people have in this damaged institution?
Yes, that, you know, the thing that worries me the most is that we come to see our Supreme Court as nothing more than, and I don't mean this as an insult to Congressman Schiff, but we come to see them as nothing more than nine robed members of Congress, that they always, you know, vote in a particular way because they were appointed by a particular person. I did look just last night at how we have looked at our Supreme Court over the years. Gallup has been asking this question since 1973. And the good news is that it has remained not just high but steady, that perceptions of the Supreme Court, its ability to rule fairly and justly, poll very, very high in this country. And so I think the answer is, I don't know. I worry about it deeply because this seems to be different. You know, I don't think what we're seeing now, at least in my memory, is anything that I've ever seen before, at least not as an adult, at least not as a, you know, an adult paying attention. And so elections have consequences. Presidents get to appoint, Senates get to confirm. But this seems to be more political than I've ever seen before. Not just polarized, but political. And that worries me deeply.
Thank you. My name is Gautam Adhikari. I'm a fellow with the Center for American Progress. As a layperson, I just wanted to know whether the president, while in office, can be prosecuted for federal crimes committed before he was in office, like tax frauds, for instance. And would it be possible to prosecute him for similar crimes, again, while he was not in office, after he has left office, because he may have pardoned himself for those crimes?
Okay, there's actually a series of embedded questions in there. And let me just dispense with them all. If people want to chime in, feel free. All of those questions are contested. Whether the president can be indicted at all is a contested question. The application of a self-pardon is a contested question. And whether the president can be made to be answerable for pre-presidential conduct is itself a contested question. So I don't think, unless people, if people have something to say on the subject, but those are really complicated, dense issues that could take an entire panel themselves. But please.
I think there was one other embedded question, which is, can a president be indicted when he is out of office? And I don't think that really is contested. Right. I think the answer is yes.
If I could just add, too, because I this had me yelling at my TV set, which I rarely do. I know most America is yelling at the TV right now, but I usually restrain myself. But I was watching the other day as the question of whether you could be impeached for prior conduct came up, and it was communicated that that was an open question. That's actually not an open question. I tried an impeachment case 10 years ago. We impeached a federal judge named Thomas Porteous for corruption. There were four articles that may be relevant to modern times. One article was purely prior conduct. Another article was lying under oath during his Senate confirmation. On a overwhelming basis, the Senate convicted on all those articles, including those two. So we now, by constitutional terms, in a country that rarely has an impeachment trial, have a very recent precedent that you can be impeached and removed from office, both for prior crimes and for lying under oath. Now, whether the evidence would rise to that level in either of the circumstances under discussion is a wholly different issue. But whether it can be constitutionally done has been resolved as recently as 10 years ago.
So one of the cool things about the Brookings Institution is you get to do something like what I'm about to do. David Priest is sitting in the audience and wants to ask a question. And y'all should just know David was Bob Mueller's CIA briefer for a long time. And so is it unusually well-positioned to ask this group a question?
And my question has nothing to do with that.
And yet we will read so much into it. Well,
one of the issues of the rule of law that is most interesting to me is the erosion of norms, the things we take for granted historically. One of those, the news just came out within the last couple of days, one of those is the inviolability of Star Wars, that Russian trolls may have been trolling the debate on the reception of the last Star Wars movie. Now, that's something I don't think, Representative Schiff, you have yet introduced legislation on, but I do recommend it. But it gets to the wider...
You know, I do represent Hollywood, so that could happen.
Exactly. It gets to the wider issue of norms. And one of the things that many of us are concerned about is the erosion of norms as a backlash to the erosion of norms we've seen. For example, stories about presidential advisors not giving him information that he would need to make national security and law enforcement decisions. Or alternatively, not executing the policies the president has declared. These are things we've historically taken for granted. And I'd like to hear each one of you just for a minute or two talk about the danger of the erosion of the rule of law, especially when it comes to longstanding norms about the presidency, and how that could impact us going forward and how we can resist that urge to allow those norms to continue to break down.
So that is a great question on which to wrap up. And we don't have a minute or two for each panelist because we actually do have to end. But let's just have, starting with Congressman and moving to the left, everybody address that, and then we will call it a morning.
Well, it is a great question, and I think that the examples you give underscore the fundamental conundrum of people working within the administration, which is how do you ethically serve a deeply unethical man? And there's simply no good answer for that. A lot of people have debated about whether Anonymous, this writer of the op-ed, should have written it at all or should have resigned or whatnot. It's all a struggle to figure out how you ethically serve both the country and nonetheless serve the president. And I don't have a clear answer to it. I don't know that there's a way to legislate that particular norm. I would have to imagine that in the example that you gave, that our intelligence agencies would give the president all the information he needs to make the decision without sourcing it, without, unless the president demanded to know, risking those sources by gratuitously telling the president what they are. And that's obviously far from ideal, but then the situation is far from ideal. I have been saying for some time that the flaw that emanates from this deeply immoral man is affecting the whole of government, and it is. But I have to say, and I hate to leave on this bleak a note, as I watched the rally last night, where the president denigrated Dr. Ford and the crowd applauded, it occurred to me that the flaw of that character is infecting the country, and just what a vital role the president, a president, traditionally has in making us a more perfect union. And when you don't have a president who views that as a part of his job, how deeply destabilizing and destructive it is for the country.
Mary?
I think you also raise a really important question. I think it's very difficult for a lot of people working in government right now, particularly in the department. I will tell you, you know, as a career person myself, I had intended to stay until my successor was appointed. And that became increasingly difficult, really, not only from the time this president took office, but certainly from the time Senator Sessions came into the department as the attorney general. Some of that was for policy reasons, and some of it. So I think ultimately I came to the conclusion that because I didn't feel that I could actively undermine policy decisions and other things that were being done, I needed to leave. Others have chosen a different course. I have felt badly about leaving many times because I feel like everybody can't leave. If everybody leaves, we're in a real problem. But for me, in the role I was in, interfacing with the Attorney General every single day, and seeing some of the things that were happening, how national security was being used as a justification for policy actions that weren't justified by national security, for me, the decision was to leave. But I think it's a difficult one, and I don't really condone purposefully trying to undermine the president, but I also understand why people would feel the need to do that.
Chuck, wrap us up.
I will. And by the way, I had the pleasure of seeing David every morning when I was on Bob Mueller's staff in 2002 and 2003 at, I think, 7 a.m. on a good day. Which is essentially 4 hours after Bob Mueller got to the office. I have a rather simplistic and binary view of this, David, which is that you serve faithfully and any president is entitled to faithful service, or you resign. And I've been thinking about that for not a long time, but since that anonymous article came out, whether I'm taking too simplistic a view, whether there should be a middle ground. I'm still of the belief that there is not, that it is a binary choice, and you do one of the two. You serve faithfully or you resign. Because I think that middle ground can be dangerous, because then you have people picking their own path. And that is, in a sense, what we're talking about here today. I believe, in a sense, that undermines the rule of law. So like Mary, I resigned. I could not stay in a job where I was uncomfortable doing the things I was being asked to do. And that only gave me one option, and I exercised it. But I'm not sure I'm right, David. It's something that I wrestle with.
Please join me in thanking the panel. So we are going to, as the panel clears, go directly into a conversation with Ken Starr, who has materialized over my right shoulder. I've done a lot of interviews in my life. I have never done an interview with somebody who not only wasn't there, but who I was facing the opposite direction from. And so this is a little bit awkward. And I apologize for that. Ken, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So there is a question that I have been thinking about in reference to you through this entire summer and spring, as these news stories have arisen that Bob Mueller is writing a report. And you are one of the few people in the country whose name is attached to the word report in quite the way it is. So as the audience may not know, I wrote a book about the Independent Counsel investigation under Ken Starr, in which I explored and critiqued your understanding of that role in relation to the reporting function of the office. And so I'm really interested in your thoughts about how we should understand these press reports that Bob Mueller is working on some kind of report. How do you understand that? And as an initial matter, what sort of report do you think he's likely working on?
It's obviously a speculative matter we cannot know. I have great confidence, by the way, in Bob Mueller and his professionalism and his integrity. But when we go to the regulations under which he's operating, we see a very stark difference with the regime that Congress, I think, unwisely inaugurated in 1978, creating the then special prosecutor, then independent counsel provisions, because 595C of that statute pointed very expressly toward impeachment. It was a thumb on the scales, setting forth a very modest standard, requiring the independent counsel, in words that were quite obligatory, very clear, shall bring to the House of Representatives when there is, quote, substantial and credible information that an impeachable offense, left, of course, undefined, may have been committed. We're in a totally different regime now. And it's a better regime. That is to say, Bob was appointed by the Justice Department, is an officer of the Justice Department, and is operating under the policies and directives of the Justice Department. I cannot imagine that whatever report he is working on is one that is designed to be a public kind of document, as opposed to a document that gives an accounting to the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, who then may do what he wants to with it, including obviously an information sharing role with the Justice Department, with the Congress. So I think we are dealing with a much healthier and much less politicized approach. One of the many flaws of the independent counsel statute, quite apart from the appointment process, removing the appointment process from the executive branch and putting it into a special apparatus of the judiciary and putting the judiciary in a very odd and awkward position is that there is nothing in the regulations that refers to impeachment. So as Bernie Nussbaum, the very able first counsel to President Clinton, said, and I'm paraphrasing, don't sign this reauthorization of this law. This is a dagger aimed at the heart of the presidency. And that's precisely, I think, what it was. We're out of that, and I think we've depoliticized the process by virtue of the Chan Arena regulations.
So your assumption is that whatever, when the press or the president's lawyers, who seem to be the sources of all of these relevant stories, when the press talks about Mueller working on a report on obstruction, that it is not an impeachment referral at all?
That would be my assumption. Now, again, Bob Mueller reports to the Deputy Attorney General, and the Deputy Attorney General has to, in Jeff Sessions' absence due to his recusal, has to interpret those regulations. So there may be an interpretive gloss in light of the facts that in an exercise of discretion, the report should in fact be more fulsome, more complete, more thorough, as opposed to what one might contemplate is an executive summary that doesn't necessarily lay out the evidence pro and con. And one of the reasons is that if indictments are not sought, then the Justice Department is under its traditional policies not to be holding press conferences, setting forth reasons, information, why it's not taking action in terms of going to the grand jury and seeking an indictment. That's part of our protections, I think, as a free people, and part of the criticisms that were directed, I think, quite properly at then-Director Comey, that he should not have been holding these press conferences explaining the reasons why he did not think an indictment was appropriate. He, for a number of reasons, including usurping the powers and authority of the Justice Department. So I think we're just at a very different and healthier structural environment, much more consistent with our system of accountability under separation of powers.
If we assume that you're correct, that whatever Mueller is working on is a document to be sent to the Deputy Attorney General, the Acting Attorney General, not a document meant to be sent to Congress, and that it may not have some of the same narrative or sort of broadly elucidating material, but maybe much sparer than the final reports of the Independent Counsel under the Independent Counsel law or the impeachment referral that you guys wrote. This puts an enormous premium on the role of Rod Rosenstein, the Deputy Attorney General, who, I don't know if coincidentally or not, cut his teeth working for you in the Office of Independent Counsel.
Right.
Rosenstein has been kind of famously under enormous pressure of late and wedged between the Office of Special Counsel, which he has, in my opinion, done a remarkable job of protecting and allowing to do its work, and a president who, you know, publicly regards it as a witch hunt and decries it as 17 angry Democrats in a fashion that must have resonance for you in terms of the way people used to talk about your office. Talk about the role of Rod Rosenstein here and the, you know, every day we wake up and there's a suggestion that today may be his last day in office. How should we understand who Rod Rosenstein is with reference to this whole process?
Rod has just rock-ribbed integrity. He is completely committed to the rule of law. He turns square corners. He will call them as he sees them. So in terms of the report, I could see him in the exercise of his discretion. I think he has discretion under the regulations. I could see two reports being prepared, somewhat analogous to a proposed indictment. As I recount in my recently published book we seriously contemplated the indictment of Hillary Rodham Clinton for various and sundry wrongdoings in Arkansas. That proposed indictment was supported by a very elaborate prosecution memo. I could see now, under the current circumstances, an executive summary, a much more summary document by definition, and then a very thorough report that would not, in fact, be submitted to Congress, but that would, again, be a discretionary call by Rod Rosenstein. I think the country should have complete confidence in Rod, given his impeccable record. And yes, I did work alongside him. He was on our trial team that resulted in the jury convictions after a very hard-fought three-month trial in Arkansas. The president, the first ladies at the time, business partners Jim and Susan McDougal, and then the sitting governor, Jim Guy Tucker. These are serious felonies connected with the collapse of Madison Guarantee Savings and Loan. Rod came to us from the Justice Department. He returned to the Justice Department, where he had a very splendid record. And then, of course, I think as everyone in this audience probably well knows, he served with great distinction as United States Attorney in the best traditions of the Justice Department. He was appointed by a Republican president and remained as United States Attorney with a Democratic president, with the enthusiastic support of two Democratic senators. Rod is a Republican, but above all, he's a rule of law guy. So I think we should have great confidence in him, including just in his courage. The prior panel talked about, do you resign as a matter of conscience and so forth. Rod Rosenstein is that kind of person. He will, if directed, I don't think he will be, to take action that he thinks is inconsistent with the rule of law, he will resign.
One more question, and then I'll let you go. One of the striking optical differences, when you talked about how this regime is more healthy than the independent counsel regime, one of the stunning optical differences between this era and the era under the independent counsel law is whenever the Office of Special Counsel brings an indictment, it is the Deputy Attorney General, the Acting Attorney General, not Bob Mueller, who's up there at the podium giving a press conference about it. And I just want if Janet Reno, if you had been serving under this regime and Janet Reno had been situated to you the way Rod Rosenstein is situated to Bob Mueller, and she had to go out and make all the announcements or had been willing to, how would that have changed the operating environment in which you were serving?
I think it would have greatly promoted public confidence in the work of the office. Just as Bob Mueller was under assault, pardon me, we were under assault. Judge Walsh, when he was investigating during the Reagan administration, was under assault because we were out there all by ourselves. What Bob Mueller has is essentially the insulation and the protection of the Deputy Attorney General, confirmed by the Senate. I wasn't confirmed by the Senate. And Janet Reno, I am partially critical of her conduct toward the very end of our investigation. But she was a rule of law person. She was appointing independent counsels when she felt that the need was justified by the facts. I think she was obedient to the law. And for Janet Reno to go out and to announce the indictment of Jim and Susan McDougal and Jim Guy Tucker might have saved us a trial. You might have gotten a few more guilty pleas. We had a number. There were 14 criminal convictions and criminal and guilty pleas during the course of the investigation. But it shows the American people that there is, in fact, accountability in the form of our separation of powers, checks and balances, and that a Bob Mueller cannot go wildly astray on what might be viewed as a rogue kind of roving prosecutor, because we know, at least those who focused on the issue know, that he is checked by under these regulations by Rod Rosenstein.
Ken Starr, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So we are going to be joined by our second panel now and give us a second to invite them out.